Here's what you can look forward to in today's episode.
And I wasn't sure if I was going to go back to Europe or not. I didn't want that, poor girl, you know, like the pity thing. So I thought, as I'm driving down the highway back home from the funeral, I see a sign, New York City, 396 miles. And I said, you know what? Nobody's going to care about me losing my mom and my dad and like all these people in my life and being like, quote unquote, the orphan child. I think I'm going to move to New York City and see what happens. And my friends are like, oh, you're just crazy. You're grieving. You're like sad. You know, you've lost so much so quickly. And I'm like, you know, nope. I think I'm going to do it. And I got home, went online, started applying for jobs, looking at apartments, calling realtors. And, you know, like a couple months later, there I was walking into my first translation project management job in New York City and really found my place in life.
Over the last decade, the market research industry has been disrupted. Our largest agencies are struggling to keep up as their customers turn to newer, faster, and cheaper data sources. Now, we are on the edge of yet another major market shift. Now is the time for us to reassert ourselves as the rudder of the brands we love. Thank you for tuning in to the Happy Market Research Podcast, where we are charting the path for the future of market researchers and businesses. Hi, I'm Jamin Brazil, and you're listening to the Happy Market Research Podcast. Today, my guest is Nancy Hernon, CEO and co-founder of G3 Translate, and an official member of the Forbes New York Business Council. G3 Translate is a transcription and translation resource for the market research industry, offering access to today's top translation professionals and the very latest in translation and transcription software. Prior to founding G3 Translate, Nancy has spent most of her career in the translation space. Nancy, thank you very much for being on the Happy Market Research Podcast with me today.
Hi, Damon. Thank you for having me on.
So tell us a little bit about where you grew up and how your parents influenced your career.
Certainly. Well, I grew up in a small town in northeastern Ohio, kind of midway between Cleveland and Pittsburgh. So it was a town divided between the Browns and the Steelers. And I grew up with my mom, and she actually influenced me by constantly pushing that I need to be independent, and that I should, you know, definitely go for my dreams and never hold back. And when I was 16 years old, I went to her and I said, listen, mom, you know, you're always telling me to be independent. So I want to go live abroad for a year. And in a totally foreign country with total strangers, and you have to let me go. And she was not too happy about that level of independence. But in the end, I convinced her and she let me move to Germany. And that kind of changed my whole path in life. It really opened me up and broadened my perspective and helped me to get on the path that I'm on now with the translation business. And living in a foreign country, it was great.
As a parent, I'd imagine that would be terrifying if your child came to you and with that same sort of request.
You know, I think about it a lot, and it's actually not. I would love it if my kid would do the same. I really do hope she follows in my footsteps and is just as headstrong as me and demands to get her way. Actually, I'm kind of praying that she wants to go to Germany, although she's really super interested in Spanish for some reason right now. So she might be ending up in Spain or Mexico. but no, I love it. I think that, you know, we live in a global society, and it's really important to understand other cultures and to learn about it and not to just be stuck in your own little bubble.
Now, I've talked about this a number of times with respect to some of the other CEOs that we've had. And when you start operating at a global level, one of the things that becomes really apparent is that the people that are heading those companies oftentimes have grown up with some level of significant experience, I'd say, abroad.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Well, my family was a little bit skewed and weird because my mom and dad split up when I was just a little one. And we moved to the Netherlands when I was two and were there for about 2 years. And she was with a Dutchman who they never married, but they were together for the rest of her life. And so I grew up with a Dutch quote unquote stepdad in partially in the Netherlands and back in Ohio. And my father was from Austria. So I had that influence of, you know, the Arnold Schwarzenegger style German. And, you know, and I loved going abroad, and we would go abroad for vacations when I was a little girl. And then on a whim, I decided to go to school, like university in Germany, which was a real eye-opening experience from being an exchange student to actually going and trying to, like, quote unquote, immigrate to go to school there. So yeah, I think, you know, it's important to have that experience and understand, like, you know, that there are other cultures and there are other ways of thinking and doing things. And it does shape you and it changes you and helps you to see the world in a different perspective and step outside of your own personal box to look at things and really observe.
What was one of the biggest attractions to Germany for you?
It's so funny. I'm like such a spontaneous person. I chose Germany because there was a German girl that I became good friends with who was an exchange student in my high school. And also my high school happened to offer German as a class. It wasn't because of my father, strangely enough. It was just a random like, hey, you should do this. I'm like, oh yeah, I think I will. I've made a lot of decisions in my life that way. So yeah, it's just, I guess, a happy falling into place, being in the right place, the right time kind of thing.
You find that the decisions that you make in that mindset are oftentimes more right, or do you second guess them?
Definitely. I mean, I went to Germany when I was in college in the US. I went on vacation over the summer to visit some friends. And I decided to check out some of the universities over there. And I wasn't really sure what to do. And my friend handed me a coin and he said, listen, if it's heads, you're going to come back and go to university. If it's tails, you go home and just finish your education in the States. And I flipped the coin. I'm like, okay, whatever happens, this is what I'm doing. And it ended up, I was going back to Germany. So I went home from vacation and said to my mom, listen, I'm moving. I'm going to go live in Germany. I'm going to go to university there. And hey, guess what? It's a lot cheaper. So you should be happy. And she's like, yeah, it's like 4,000 miles away. I'm not too happy. I'm like, well, you know, this is the way it goes. The same, I ended up in New York City. Like literally, my mother had passed away and I wasn't sure if I was going to go back to Europe or not. I didn't want that, oh, poor girl, you know, like the pity thing. So I thought, as I'm driving down the highway back home from the funeral, I see a sign, New York City, 396 miles. I said, you know what? Nobody's going to care about me losing my mom and my dad and like all these people in my life and being like, quote unquote, the orphan child. I think I'm going to move to New York City and see what happens. And my friends are like, oh, you're just crazy. You're grieving. You're like sad. You know, you've lost so much so quickly. And I'm like, you know, nope. I think I'm going to do it. And I got home, went online, started applying for jobs, looking at apartments, calling realtors. And, you know, like a couple months later, there I was walking into my first translation project management job in New York City. And nobody cared that I was that little orphan girl. And I kind of got lost in the crowds and really, found my place in life.
You know, what's interesting to me about that is the independent spirit, but then also the ownership of where you are. So, you know, you're not treating, your lens isn't one of victim, but one of opportunity and sort of, you know, this is my life, making decisions. Bad things are going to happen, but it's not going to be the defining moment for me. Making my own way.
Definitely. Definitely. Well, you know, when you realize there's no one you have to prove anything to but yourself, I think it really alters your state of mind and your decision-making process somewhat. So I can be more impulsive and more a little crazy when I say, okay, I'm on the turn of a dime. I'm going to move to Europe. I'm going to move to New York. I'm going to do this. I'm going to start a company. Why not? What can I lose? I think going in with that thought of just let's just do it and see what happens rather than the fear of, oh no, everything could go wrong is a much, much better way to look at it.
Okay. So the why not, that is going to be the title for this episode, I think. Wait, right. I love that framing. There's when you strip away the expectations from others and even the expectations that we put on ourselves, then it starts opening up a whole different, like, I can't tell you how many people have reached out to me and said, you know, Jamin, when are you going to do the next big thing? And I'm just completely blind to trying to compare what I've done in the past to what I'm doing now and what I'll do in the future. I just could give two bad words to the expectations that other people might. And so as soon as you can step into that view of, yeah, why not? Who cares? I mean, listen, I lived through that whole 2001.com crash and as business owner, and then 2008 as well, 7 and 8 as well in the US economy. In both instances, I had to move to an apartment from a house because my personal income was basically non-existent during those years, right? And I just didn't care. I mean, you know, and it's so liberating. So that's my rant.
It is. No, you're totally right. It is. It's freeing to just go like, okay, I'm going to try this. Let's see, you know, what's going to happen. What's the worst thing that could happen?
Totally. And you know what? I've already done that. I've lived hand to mouth. I mean, there's just like, you know, who cares? We can always survive. My wife has that same sort of view. She lived in Spain right after college for several years, and she has that free spirit. And it helped that she's fluent in Spanish. So, you know, it's nice, I think, as you know, you find your soulmate, if you can both be aligned with that expectation of, yeah, you know what, it's not the things that we have or living up to the expectations of others. As long as we're providing enough, then everything's going to be okay. That can be, you know, that's a really dynamic, powerful combination.
Oh, I totally agree. I totally agree 100%. And I, you know, call me crazy, but I think the universe gives you what you need.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
And you could say it's a higher power. You could say it's your guardian angel. You could say, but I know there were times in my life when I was like, oh man, this is bad. How am I ever going to get out from under this? And something would happen, some little thing, some event, some random distribution check from an old stock that, you know, I inherited would come in the mail. And it was like, okay, all right, we're still moving. Let's go. Let's keep on. Just get up, dust off, and move forward.
I totally love that. And then on the flip side, when you think about like the upside opportunities that we've missed, you know, one example for me is I bought Yahoo when it IPO'd.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was very excited. And the stock actually didn't do anything for about 4 to 5 months. The Wall Street just didn't know what to do with an internet, with a .com. And so finally, I sold the shares. Well, I swear it was like a set on a trigger. As soon as Jamin sells the shares, let's start skyrocketing.
Oh, man.
And right? And so my stupid brother-in-law at the time would, at Christmas time, he would always... Every year he would calculate how much those shares were worth, right? And it was like some obscene amount of money. But I think to myself, you know, if that would have hit, it would have completely dictated a different direction for my life. And I'm just so thankful with where I am right now. And so, you know, in the way that sometimes bad things happen and the way that sometimes good things happen in our lives, or even misses, you know, we just, not judging them, but just reacting to them and living the life that we want to live.
Yeah, definitely. I always call that the sliding door perspective. You go through one side, you end up somewhere totally different. And the other side, you end up on the path you're on right now.
Well said. All right. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, New York City, get a job in a translation company.
Yes.
In those early days, did you know you were going to be a business owner straight away?
You know what? No, I didn't. I was in this job and working pretty happily for a very large translation company. I think you all have probably heard of it, TransPerfect. And it's funny because I'm one of those people who needs a lot of change to keep excited about something. So I started in one role and then I'm like, okay, let me go to another role. And I ended up working hand in hand with the CEO there and learning a lot about the business. And it was really interesting and exciting, and I watched it grow. And it was very cool. But at that time, I wasn't like ready yet to do anything on my own. So I decided to switch to a smaller company to see how that worked. And had left there, gone to a smaller agency, and that's where I learned about market research. And at that agency, I started working in the research space, and I met all these people. And the company was kind of a shotgun approach style. Like, they did work for every different kind of segment. It wasn't just research. It was like pharma. It was like big brands, internet companies, like you name it, and they translated it. But these researchers really struck a chord with me. I remember going to this conference in Texas, and it was for medical devices. And the girl that I had gone with to the conference knew Jamie Pulley. And she said, hey, let's go have dinner with this girl. You know, she's really cool. She's a market researcher. I'm like, oh, you know, I've been working with this a little bit. And I met her, and she was just so cool and so sweet. And I started to like get to know more people in the industry. And I said, you know, this is a totally different language. What they're doing, they're not just translating the words. It's not a manual. It's not a how-to. It's not like a website. It's really looking at people's emotions and trying to get like a feel for, you know, why they make these decisions to buy this or to vote for that. And came to me that this is something that's not really super well serviced. And at another conference with a bunch of boring medical device people again, who were not nearly as fun or interesting as the researchers, I was talking to John Labadie about this. And I was like, you know, it would be so cool to have a company that just did research, because look at us, we're standing here for a week. No one person has visited our booth. These medical device people don't care about us. They don't want to talk to us. Why are we spinning our wheels with this? Why are we trying to do everything and be everything to everybody when we could be just the best thing for one group? And he's like, yeah, that's really cool. You know, we should talk more. And over the course of that week, we formed the idea to do G3. And it was then a matter of putting together a business plan and putting together some numbers and finding some partners to invest in us. And that's kind of how it was born.
Yeah, this key of focus, I think, is so important. A lot of entrepreneurs will, and myself included, spend a lot of time kind of chasing whatever's right in front of us. I don't exactly know what the motivators are there, but the more that we hunker down and focus and really nail the niche, then I've seen a correlation with that to success.
Definitely. Definitely. Well, back then, there weren't a lot of niche agencies. Everybody was doing everything. And it's like, why? Why do you want to be okay at a little bit of everything instead of being an expert at one thing? And now, you know, obviously things have shifted, the paradigms have changed, and a lot of different agencies are kind of going that route. But back then, it was either you were a single language vendor and specialized in that language, or you were a multi-language vendor and you did everything for everybody. And I think, you know, it's not just about speaking the foreign language, it's about speaking the lingo. There's a language to what you do. There's a language to the research. There's a language to the data collection that isn't necessarily intuitive.
Yeah, 100%. It's such a great point that even though we speak English, you know, being from outside, even if you're in marketing, if you move into market research, there is definitely a nomenclature, way things are framed, et cetera, that, you know, that exists. But then a level under that is the treatment of data, whether you're qualitative or quantitative, right? There's nuances, or there, I would say more than nuances. There's just like complete frameworks that have to be understood if you're going to operate in those areas successfully. And that's one of the biggest challenges I've encountered with translation is we'll ask a question and then, you know, it gets translated in 19 languages or whatever. And the translation to the other languages oftentimes isn't back translated. And then that's when, you know, when we skip that step, we have wound up in trouble, especially if the client has offices in that area and there's native speakers that, you know, wind up reading the questions. Thinking about one specific project that I had with BRS out of Menlo Park, this goes way back, and we didn't back translate, and it was in Japanese. Oh my gosh, it was just catastrophic, right? So anyways, are companies spending the time on the back translation still, or is that a step that's starting to move away?
It depends on the company. It depends on their internal processes. I find a lot of companies don't have time to back translate, and it's okay. I mean, the way we do things at our company is we do a three-step process. So we're translating, we're editing, and we're proofreading. So we already have three sets of eyes looking at it. And, you know, by the time it's gotten through that third set of eyes, it should be pretty perfect.
Right.
And then if a client reviewer comes online and decides, okay, we want to change it because this is our internal language or this is how we want to say this, that's you know, a collaborative effort and it works pretty well. But you mentioned Japan specifically, and that's funny because we like to get the buy-in from the very beginning on Japanese. It's a cultural thing. In Japan, if I asked you, I said, Jamin, I need you to look at this. Can you tell me what you think? If you didn't give me that document back with a lot of red lines, I would feel like you didn't do your job and you would lose face.
Right.
So what we do for that is we try to get those reviewers on with the translators, do a little sample in the beginning, have them chat it out, talk to each other, and then you find a lot less red lines in the back end when they're reviewing it after all the translations are done. So.
God, where was that gym 20 years ago? I mean, now that you say that, it's like a veil has been lifted up. It makes perfect sense. That's so funny. Yeah. Anyway, that was probably like one of the hardest projects I ever worked on. In fact, it was so bad. I drove 4 hours to meet with the client. And we had a two days where we shipped in food and worked just straight, you know, 16 plus hours a day with their constituents in Japan. And boy, it was such a problem. But culturally, you know, you're right. So that's the other piece of it that's super interesting is, you know, and a lot of times, you know, language is by definition culture. And so you're setting that framework for, you know, they're just words, but the reality is there's a lot of like how I interact with the language that can be, depending on the culture, obviously, be considered.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, how we process things is very different across cultures. And, you know, we're all just people and you would kind of, a lot of people just make the assumption, well, you know, we live in a Western society, the French live in a Western society, as do the Germans and the Brits. But the way we look at things, the way we rate things is very, very different. You know, in one culture, I think it's, and hopefully I'm not wrong here, I'm sure I'll get a lot of comments, but I believe it's in Spain where they tend to be a little nicer and rate things higher, or maybe it was Brazil, just because that's their positive spin on life. On a scale of 1 to 5, they're going to choose the 5, you know, much more often than a German who might actually think it's a great product, but they're just going to be like, oh, well, there's one little thing, so I'm going to give it a 4. So it's funny. Like we do, we see the world in a different way, even though we may feel similarly, the way we express it is going to be different. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I one of the co-founders of Decipher, Erwin Andreessen, we went to this nice restaurant. He tells me the soup is the best soup I've ever had in my entire life. And he's a bit of a foodie. And the waiter came over with traditional American, right? Says, how's your food? And he looked at him and goes, it's satisfactory. And so he didn't mean it like in a bad way. He's just like, you know, and the waiter was literally trying to decide, should I discount the meals, or, you know, for him, it was this insult that it wasn't,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, totally. But
completely, yeah. Lost in translation, as it were.
Oh, it's so true. It's so true. It's so funny how that works. I remember moving when I was a kid and living there in university. And yeah, I made quite a few cultural snafus with my American ways. And yeah, I just didn't get it at the time. And it took me a while to learn the culture. And I think, you know, that again, like with the translation element, you have to understand the culture and who you're talking to. Because there is a very different way of communicating. And yeah, Americans, and I live in Northern Germany, and they tend to be a little bit colder and more standoffish. And I hate to stereotype, but stereotypes are there for a reason. Sometimes. And, I remember the first 6 months going to school, nobody talked to me. They didn't know who I was. And they didn't know I was a foreigner because I was scared to open my mouth and sound stupid, because my German was mediocre. And, then I busted out of my shell one day and was this gregarious, like, oh, I love it. Oh, this is so great. And blah, blah, blah. And they're like, oh my God, you're an American.
You've been an American wolf in sheep's clothing.
Like, look at this girl. She's just crazy. She's just so, very vociferous, not reserved. And it was pretty funny. But once I did make some friends and they opened up, I found them to be the warmest people and the most loyal people in the world. Like, I know I could call on any single one of them for anything at any time. And it's funny, but looking from outside, I thought, oh man, these people are cold. They hate me. They're never going to like me. And now, after time, it's just a matter of them warming up to you and you understanding how they communicate. And I feel pretty confident now when I go to Germany that it's all good.
That's awesome. So as a seasoned entrepreneur, we know that sometimes the roller coaster goes up and sometimes it goes down. What has been one of your biggest challenges that you faced?
For us, I think at G3, one of the biggest challenges is talent. As a small company, it's hard. Like when you're first starting out, people are like, oh, they're just starting out. They might not be here. We don't want to work there. They might shut their doors in a minute. So getting those first project managers on board to trust, to know that we're good and we're going to be here and they're not going to, be out of a job the next day was hard. And then because, again, we're a small business, every time a team member would get on board and we'd be rolling and everything is great. And we're like, this is the best team ever. We've got this awesome balance. Oh, well, I'm going to go back to school, or, oh, I want to move back to France, or I want to get married and not work anymore. And it's like, oh man, that was always so, so painful trying to fill those gaps once you had it built. It feels like, we're constantly upgrading and updating. And that to me is challenging because as much as I like to make changes and decisions on the turn of a dime, I also can be very much routine in my day to day, and getting new people in and getting to know them, I find that challenging. Getting them up to speed on what we do and how we do it and why we do it. So that's been tough, finding the right people and getting them, into the team, and then rolling with the punches when they decide to do something new.
My view on business is that the team is the most important asset of an organization. And it's interesting how we treat it, and we have to, I realize, but we treat it like a cost center as it relates with, the view of the financial view of the business. And it does cost money, so I'm not obviously an idiot, but it's the asset. I mean, it's the thing that enables us to, it's the part of the company that enables us to be able to consistently deliver excellent experiences for customers.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. And that, like you're saying, the seeding of that team and then the ongoing maintenance of it and growth, etc., that happens at a personal level and at a company level is something that takes a ton of intentionality. And as there's transitions, it can really set you back as a business owner.
Definitely. Well, we had in the very beginning, we had a team of three people, and then me and John, so we were five, and one decided to go back to college. And we're like, oh my God, we're never going to survive this. Like, what are we going to do? Because everybody was friends. We all got along. It was going out to happy hour after work was definitely a thing, And then all of a sudden our family was breaking up, and it was really heartbreaking and hard. But, we learned from it and we grew, and it was fine in the end. But yeah, you become attached to these people in your life. And I think it's important to have those interpersonal relationships on your team because you're spending so much of your day with them. So much of your life is spent in the office or at work or, talking on the phone to these people. And if you don't like them, then what are you doing? Something's wrong. And I think, team is having a strong team is really, really important in having the right personalities.
So what do you see as core characteristics of all-star employees?
Well, let's see. I guess it depends on the business, but for our business, I think most important is having that cultural experience in life and understanding that the small town that you grow up in is not the end-all be-all of society. But also being team player is really important to us. And I know that sounds cliche, but we all wear like so many hats and play so many different roles because we're a small business. We have to be able to do a lot of different things and to help each other out and to fill in the gaps where one person is not able to do something, the other person can jump in and help out. So that team player, like we're all here in this together thing, is really important. I think the lone wolf type on our team wouldn't work because it's a very collaborative thing what we're doing here. And having the feedback and the passing of the knowledge and the training each other is really key so that we can all be well-rounded and give our clients what they need and meet all of the demands, because it is a very demanding business. Research is very fast-paced and you can't afford to fall down. You have to keep going, and having your team have your back is what makes that possible. So I think those are the two things that are most important to our company.
There's been a ton of investment by the large internet companies, Google, AWS, you know, Amazon, Services, and others, in the area of both transcription and translation. I remember when the iPhone launched visual voicemail, mm-hmm. and you know, I had no idea what to expect, and then boom, you know, there it is. So how are you seeing those? Are you seeing those as complementary or competitive to your business? And what do you think the next couple of years holds as it relates with translation and transcription?
Yep. Well, as far as translation goes, I think it's super exciting. I remember sitting in a room years and years ago with a group that focuses on the automation of translation and the different types of forms in which it has evolved from. And I think that the use of the neural networks and AI is going to definitely be a big game changer, probably not even 5 years out, probably less. I know that Amazon, I think it was, or maybe it was Google, had claimed parity with Chinese to English, which is pretty amazing. But for some reason, Chinese works really, really well with those networks and as far as translating pretty accurately. For what we do in particular, I think it's complementary because, again, research language isn't a manual. It's not a legal contract. It's something that's looking for emotion. And as close as these artificially intelligent machines may be to understanding and mimicking emotion, they don't feel, at least not yet. And I don't know that they'll ever feel the same way that we do. So I think that while it will help speed up the process by providing initial translations, we're always going to have someone reading it for culture, reading it for nuance, reading it for the subtext, the feeling that's underneath the underlying words and editing that. So are we going to be out of business? No. Are the companies who translate the documentation for Ford cars? Maybe. But I think for what we do, it's an exciting, innovative way of getting things done quicker, probably cheaper, and just complementary to what we already do. And the same for transcription. You know, they're always going to need a little bit of massaging here and there, I think. But the transcriptions are pretty scary. For the translation side, I'm more confident. The transcription side, It's pretty scary how accurate it can be. But I think right now, it's not there yet. In a couple of years, it may well be pretty darn close. But I think the human touch is still going to be needed.
So we had a couple of questions on LinkedIn I just wanted to ask.
Sure.
One is, how is your API integration coming along? And this is from Aaron Taylor, the CPO of Critical Mix.
Oh, I know Aaron. He's great. our API, so we have two different types of API that we offer to our clients. obviously they're just connectors. So it's a plug and it has to be customized for the end user. We have that ready. If he wants to talk to me, tell him to give me a call about it. Yeah, we have that. And we also have a portal that a lot of our clients prefer because they don't want to do the customization work for the API. So they log into our portal, submit and track stuff and do billing and all that through there. So we have a couple of different paths that you can take to reach us with your needs.
You had also had a couple of shout outs, Bailey Buchanan and a few others. Really excited about this interview dropping. You have to check out that LinkedIn thread.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And Bailey's awesome. She is this amazing supporter of women in research, which I also support and love. I think it's a super great organization, helping women to help each other out in this industry. I know it's not applicable to you, but to all the girl listeners out there, they should definitely look into it. It's a great, great group of people.
Well, I will say, you know, when Kristen Luck started Women in Research, she did that inside of Decipher. Jamie Plunkett and myself were big advocates of that specific initiative. So both in terms of supporting it financially as well as from an infrastructure perspective.
Nice.
So yeah, we're 100% on that. You know, the diversity is this interesting. So we're calendarizing our podcast drops going into 2019. I don't know what the themes are going to be. Anyway, so as we're going through that process, all of a sudden things like Black History Month, and I'm thinking, gosh, you know, that's interesting. When I think about, you know, the African American leaders in America in market research, and incorporating their voice intentionally, because one of the things that I've learned from Kristen is the importance of diversity for improving financial outcomes.
Oh yeah.
Right. And so forget about, like, no matter what your lens is, right? Just operate there at a baseline and improve your outcomes by having a more full view of the market and the competitive set and where you're winning and where you're struggling. That's just key.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There was actually, not to be too competitive with the other guys out there, but I think about a year ago, there was an article saying that women CEOs are more profitable than their male counterparts, like the businesses are more profitable because they take things from a different perspective.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I haven't seen the statistics. I have heard them. I haven't done validation against them, but it's just across the board. There's so much benefit among women-run organizations. Mm-hmm. And of course, we can always point to other ones as well. So,
oh, yeah.
But anyway, you know, but the broader point I think is so important, which is we need to have an attitude of inclusion, intentional inclusion. Because sometimes it's hard, just because they're, you know, the bench isn't particularly deep for whatever reason. And what's interesting about market research is actually minorities and women specifically are so dominant at the, from, you know, from a numbers perspective, at the, I'll call it the, you know, the, think about the org chart where most of the people are sitting. But as you go up the org chart, it does seem to be a lack of women leadership in those veins. But what the work that you're doing with Women in Research, and obviously being a successful entrepreneur, is certainly helping solve that problem.
Here's hoping, definitely. Thank you.
So, what are you guys offering right now at G3 Translate that Insights Nation can take advantage of?
So, Insights Nation, we have some introductory offers if you would like to work with us. Send us over your information and what you're looking for, and we will give you a special discount.
That's huge.
We'll definitely take some off for you to give back a little bit to the listeners.
Love it. So Insights Nation, this is a great opportunity for you to experience some value as a listener of Happy Market Research. I think I'm going to start using the show trying to be a little bit more intentional. I've been surprised that people haven't been a little bit more intentional that have been on the show. I think there's always fear of asking, but we are in business after all, right? And
yeah.
And this is a great platform for you to be able to take advantage of offering value to the audience. So thank you for that. If people do, Nancy, want to get in contact with you to hear more about the special offer, how would they do that?
They could either contact me at nancy@g3translate.com or just visit our website, g3translate.com, or link with me on LinkedIn, Nancy Hernon, H-E-R-N-O-N. And those are my main methods of contact.
My guest today has been Nancy Hernon, CEO and co-founder of G3 Translate. Nancy, thank you so much for being on the Happy Market Research Podcast.
Thank you, Jamin. It was a pleasure.
And thank you, everyone who has been listening. As always, greatly appreciate the reviews on Apple iTunes and Google Play specifically. Oh, as well as Spotify. That audience is growing as well. So keep those coming. It helps other people like you find value and improve market research. Have a great day. On our next episode, we interview Katrina Noel, president of No Research. You'll want to tune in to hear her talk about the art and science of listening. This is a fun episode packed full of tips for qualities and quanties alike. There's a lot to be gained, nothing to lose. Talk to you soon.